It is 2:06 on a Wednesday afternoon. You're listening to Political Rewind. We're coming to you live from the Midtown Atlanta studios of Georgia Public Broadcasting. And hope you're all across the state of Georgia having a great day. We have a terrific panel here today. We have Andy Miller. He's the CEO and editor of Georgia Health News. And Andy, I'm thrilled you could be here because, for me at least, I need a primer on how healthcare, Obamacare to begin with, and then what we think might replace it's going to work. So we're going to get to that during the show, and I'm glad you could be here to help us with that.
Glad to be here, Bill.
We also have Kevin Riley, the editor of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, back with us. It's good to see you. And before we go any further, let's give your investigative team a plug. You just won a big award for your really sweeping series on doctors who, what's the correct word, abuse, exploit the women who've been their patients.
Right. The title of the series was Doctors and Sex Abuse, and we just got a big award from the investigative reporters and editors. So we're thrilled with the honor and just thrilled to do this kind of work for our readers and subscribers.
And congratulations to you and your team for that, because I know that was an enormous commitment of resources. So good for you.
Thank you, Bill. And it's good to be here, as
good,
always.
Good. And Billy Linville. Billy Linville does what we call government relations work, government affairs work. It means he's a lobbyist in both state capital and I think in capitals in the South, probably, Billy. You're not just working here in Georgia, right?
I work around the country.
He's been a Democratic strategist. He worked with Governor Roy Barnes back when the governor was in office downtown. So we're glad to have you, Billy. Before we move into the topics of our show today, a couple quick notes. Number one, tweet us at PoliticsGPB. And I suggest that might be even more important than usual today because as we talk about healthcare, and we're going to get into it in a pretty significant way, you may have questions or comments, and I think Andy and the rest of us here would love to hear what you have to say and try to respond to what you're thinking. The other quick thing that I want to do before we get started on that subject is tell you that we're going to do another. We call them voter panels during the election campaign, where we reached out to you and invited you to be on our show to talk about the issues and the candidates and how you were feeling about things. Well, now that the election is over, we're going to start doing a series of citizen panels throughout 2017. And we're going to do this the same way we did the voter panels. I'm going to give you a phone number. You call that number. There'll be a recorded message. Producer Lisa Clark recorded the message. And what you need to do is tell us why you're a good person to be on our citizen panel. If you talk too long, if you leave too long a message, that's almost a guarantee you won't be on our citizen panel. So make your message succinct. And as we listen to the calls coming in, we'll get back to you. So here's the phone number, and we'll repeat it a couple times during the show. I don't have a date for the panel yet, but we'll have that shortly. Call us at 678-757-4472. 678-757-4472. Why don't we tweet that number out to Jenny so people can have it who are following us on Twitter. And again, we'd love to hear from you. Those were some of the most popular shows we did in 2016. So we look forward to hearing from you why you should be on that panel. And Jim Galloway of the AJC and I will lead that discussion probably sometime in mid-February. All right, enough of the business. Let's get right to the topic at hand. Andy Miller, we know that this week, Congressman Tom Price from Georgia had his real confirmation hearings. This week in front of the Senate Finance Committee was really where the rubber meets the road. Last week, it was more of a courtesy hearing. He got some tough questions. And among them, Democratic senators like you're an old Ohio man, Kevin, I know, Sherrod Brown and others wanted to know just how big a role Tom Price was going to play in crafting the policy that will replace Obamacare. Let's just listen to a little of that.
President Trump said he's working with you on a replacement plan for the ACA, which is nearly finished and will be revealed after your confirmation. Is that true?
It's true that he said that, yes.
So did not that he's ever done this before, but did the president lie? Did the president lie about this, that he's not working with you? He said he's working with you. Is that? I know we don't use the word lie here because we're polite when presidents say statements that aren't true, but did he lie to the public about working with you?
I've had conversations with the president about health care, yes.
Which wasn't quite the answer.
So, Andy, really the reason we played that is to say there's no question that once he's confirmed, and despite concerns that we're going to talk about later in the show that some Democrats have about Price, he will be confirmed almost certainly.
Right.
He's going to play a role in all this, a big role.
Absolutely. I mean, he's an expert on health care. He's not only a physician, but he's been studying and working on this issue for many years. He's a smart guy, and he's had ideas about what we should do in terms of getting rid of Obamacare, what should we replace it. And obviously Trump wants to do that, so I assume he'll have a heavy role in crafting what they're going
to
do.
All right, so let's to start this conversation. Right. And I consider this, for me, a primer. For me, a dummy's guide to health care, because I think it's so much more complicated than for me to grasp it all. So help walk us through this, and Billy and Kevin will jump into the conversation. First of all, what are the basic tenets? What are the underpinnings of the current plan, the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare? What are the essentials there?
Well, let's start with what happened before Obamacare. You had 50 million people did not have insurance in this country. You had something called pre-existing conditions where insurers would either not give coverage to these folks or charge them a lofty, very high rate. You also had a lot of medical errors going on in hospitals, and you had also people and corporations were complaining about the cost of health care, and individuals were too. Healthcare costs always go up, Bill. And so that was the situation. The healthcare system was essentially broken, and Republicans would say that as well as Democrats. So enter Obama and his Obamacare legislation. The Affordable Care Act was passed in 2010. Some of the things that it did were very popular, such as allowing kids on to stay on their parents' plan until age 26. I had a daughter who did that, and it was great. Also, the pre-existing conditions went away, and insurance companies, not only in the exchange, which was created under Obamacare, but also private employers and public employers, it went away. So in other words, people weren't rated based on whether they had asthma or diabetes or a cancer in their family. That was a very popular thing, and insurance companies bought it, and they decided, okay, we're going to do that, and they agreed to that. But what the insurance companies wanted in exchange for that is to get a lot of young people into the system.
And because the young are the healthier, we assume, are healthier and can help cover the cost of older people like me who might get sick and really need it. Is that the fairest way to say it?
Exactly. You get the 25-year-olds who maybe go to the doctor once a year or maybe not even that, to balance off the costs of older folks like ourselves. And that was the reason why insurance companies bought into the idea of Obamacare, one of the big tenets of it. So people were required, most people were required to have insurance or pay a penalty.
And that's where what we call the individual mandate comes in, right? The individual mandate means if I don't have insurance, I'm going to pay a penalty when I file my income tax.
That's correct, yes. And that penalty has gone up over the years. So now it's $695 or 2.5% of income, whichever is greater.
Andy, a couple things, though, just to clarify. One of the criticisms of the Affordable Care Act, which is called Obamacare, and which some people don't realize is the same thing, is that those penalties maybe weren't big enough to inspire people to sign up.
I think that's a valid criticism. And yeah. I think if they were going to redo it or continue it, I think they would make them higher than what they are now. But I think that's one reason why they're higher now than they were 2-3 years ago. And I think that's one reason why people are signing up this year, even though they know or they believe that Obamacare is going away.
I think it's important also to point out that what became the Affordable Care Act was initially born in the conservative Heritage Foundation. and the mandate was viewed as a conservative principle in terms of paying what you owe.
You're talking about Romney care. You're talking about Romney care now, because because Massachusetts under Governor Romney had essentially the same plan, and they got a lot of people covered. You know, it was like 95% covered in Massachusetts, and everybody got behind it, and it was a success.
And it is market based.
What does that mean? It's market based. Let's really help people like me understand what that means.
All right. So one thing that President Obama could have done is just say, okay, we're going to have this government-run exchange. But they decided, along with the Democrats, and they didn't get any Republican buy-in, but to have private insurers offer these plans and these exchanges for individuals and families to sign up. So it did have a market part to it. I think one thing that the Republicans are now going to look at is they're going to say, we need to get less in government. In whatever we're going to do, we're going to have less government and more private market. But don't forget, government pays already through Medicare and Medicaid and various employee plans. Government pays more than half of the bills in health care. So you're not going to get it out of health care. You're not going to remove government.
Andy, you also mentioned, like, when all this started, 50 million Americans without health care. Now, that number dropped dramatically.
Now 29 million.
So
21 million people got coverage.
So there's 21 million kind of happy people out there, you might argue.
Especially those that have asthma, diabetes, cancer, something in
pre-existing
conditions. We're told that one out of every four Americans has a pre-existing condition.
And therein represents the challenge that Tom Price has, right? I mean, how do you make this big change and not turn 21 million or even more people against you?
That's correct. And so if you get rid of the individual mandate that Bill talked about, how are you going to get the young people into the coverage system in order to balance off the older and sicker people?
Okay, go ahead, Billy.
Well, point out also that we now have the lowest uninsured rate we've ever had in history, and I think that health care inflation are rising at its lowest rate in decades.
That's true in both cases, but I think one of the problems with Obamacare this year, and it got all the headlines, was the fact that people's premiums and the exchanges went up.
And that was exactly the next question I was going to ask. Let's talk about that. Is that a flaw? You said, right as you started talking, that insurance premiums always go up. Without regard to what systems are in place, would this have happened in any case, or is there some flaw in Obamacare that created a situation in which these premiums shot up in some cases 25-30%? Yes?
That's true. Now, I'm going to give you a complicated answer to that. I'll try to boil it down.
Thank you.
My guess is all of us who have private insurance through an employer, my guess is all of our premiums went up, right? This past year or the year before. The reason is because healthcare costs keep going up. The price of your pharmaceuticals, the price of your doctor visits, your hospital stays, that all goes up. I mean, that's a fact about healthcare. Now, the issue with the premiums and the exchange going up so much is there were a couple things that went on. First of all, insurers said, look, we're losing money. Companies like Aetna and United Healthcare said, well, look, we're going to get out of this business right now. And there were some flaws in the way Obamacare was set up. I think if, for instance, if an insurance company had a lot of sick people in their mix of a pool of insured, that they should have gotten more money from the government in order to cover those costs. But some of them got a bad pool of, I won't say bad pool, but they got a lot of sicker people. And so that's where they lost a lot of money. It definitely happened that the premiums went up, but don't forget, Bill, that most people in the exchange, 85% of them, got subsidies to offset that cost.
It's from the federal government.
From the federal government. And so it's just like buying a car. You know, you don't pay the sticker price. And consumers got the subsidies raised. And so what happened at the end of the day is premiums did go up, but people's subsidies went up. And so they didn't get hit that hard.
So let's back up just a second and talk about the politics of this. Kevin and Billy, let me get you to weigh in on this. It's already been mentioned. Obamacare didn't get a single Republican vote. It was passed entirely by Democratic support, some of it by reconciliation, the very same measure that Republicans are going to use to unwind it. But there were votes, and only Democrats voted for it. You can't, Kevin Riley, I would argue, sustain any major program like that if it's entirely done by one party.
Bill, I think you're right, and I actually think that's what we're going to be up against again, is are we going to keep seesawing back and forth on this issue? And one of the great truisms about the Affordable Care Act was this. If you polled people, as we did in Georgia at the AJC, and asked them what they thought about Obamacare, unbelievably unpopular. If you polled them about specific aspects of the law, as Andy had talked
pre-existing conditions, 26-year-olds remaining in their parents'
all
policy,
of that stuff, those things were wildly popular.
Well, Billy, you actually point out something, even to take it a step further. When you poll people on Obamacare, they're negative. When you call it the Affordable Care Act, they tend not to be negative.
They're not as negative, right. And I think that the challenge here is you know, I don't want to oversimplify, is that lots of Americans like what happened, even if they say they hate Obamacare. Right, Andy?
I mean, I mean, the latest national poll showed that like 47% of people wanted to keep Obamacare. Another 28% wanted to change it, to fix it, to, you know, to move it this way and that way. And only 20% wanted just to get rid of it and forget about it. So it is more popular than people think, and maybe more popular than a lot of Republicans think.
Well, politically now, the Republicans and Donald Trump own health care. And
they're saying they don't own Obamacare. I mean, Billy, you know that, right? I mean, they're all arguing, we're not going to own this Obamacare.
Well, they certainly have the votes to repeal it if they want to repeal it, which the Republicans voted over 50 times to do when Obama was president. So they're going to own this, and I think it's a classic case of the dog caught the truck. Because those 20 million or plus people who now have health insurance because of Obamacare, they're those working class voters that Donald Trump was able to get to support him. And so he's promised that every American is going to have health insurance. They walk that back to say access to health insurance. But I think they're in a bind, and they're going to have a difficult problem really getting out of this.
This will be the toughest issue for the Trump administration to resolve. In the right way. You can throw in immigration, you can throw in job creation, all this. Health care will be the most difficult.
Because
it is so difficult.
Well, and you just, it strikes me that one of the great ironies is that there are many observers of the Obama years who would say that taking on health care as his first issue was a terrible, terrible mistake. Now, the positive side of that would be he's got more capital at that moment in his presidency, the very beginning, than any other time. So he had to take on perhaps the toughest issue. But there are certainly many, Kevin Riley, who would argue it hurt the entire rest of his tenure because it was so controversial. It required such heavy lifting. It was so complicated. And as it's being unwound, the question is whether there's any legacy left at all. And now the Republicans, Billy says, they now own health care, and in that sense, they do. Suddenly, President Trump's going to have to take this on as one of his first big issues.
I wish that I could sort of go into the future and 50 years see what history says about this. Because on one hand, if President Obama had not done health care as the first thing, he would have been able to do nothing, I would argue. He just would never have had the capital.
Okay.
And the Republicans now waver, but, I mean, it's hard to find anyone who doesn't talk about, well, we're going to fix it, we're going to repeal and replace, you know, all that. But I think history will say President Obama changed the healthcare system, and what may be lost is all the complications that came after that.
All right,
because
we,
look at FDR and Social Security. No one talks about what changed after he did that.
We're going to have to take a break in a second. But before we do, can you frame this in a Georgia context for us, please, Andy? How popular is Obamacare? We don't have a state exchange, of course, but Georgians buy through the federal exchange. How popular has it been here?
Well, you had more than 500,000 people signed up for the exchange this current year, back in 2016. And this current year, you're going to see about the same, even though this specter of repeal is out there.
So We have well over a million plus Georgians who are covered now by the Affordable Care Act.
Well, it's 500,000
a
year.
Oh, I see. I apologize.
So,
I see.
But we're not seeing...
Re-upping.
Exactly.
Okay,
a lot
sorry.
Of them are re-upping.
Sorry.
Among those 500,000 plus people, I mean, it's out there doing the job. And don't forget, going back to pre-existing conditions, all Georgians are enjoying insurance now where they don't have to worry about a pre-existing condition. People who have private insurance, people in employer plans, there's no more of that.
All right, let's take a break and continue the conversation. We have a lot of people tweeting, and we want to get to some of those. But when we come back, why don't we talk about what we think we can expect from Republicans. You tell us, Andy, what a huge challenge it is. Let's talk about where they might be headed. It's 2:27 on Wednesday afternoon. This is Political Rewind. Really quick break, and we'll be right back.
I'm Robert Krulwich from Radiolab. We're told that smell triggers memory. So if you're in your car, you roll up your windows and inhale. What do you remember? Like the smell of a favorite dog jumping in the back seat long ago? A diaper moment, perhaps. There are some memories you cherish and others that just linger. How about contributing this barrel of aroma to your favorite public radio station? And you might even get a tax deduction.
Go to gpb.org/cars and thanks.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Kevin Riley, the editor of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, is here. Always love having the boss in here. Thank you.
I know. Where are all these people who work for me? What are they doing?
Billy Linville joins us as well, and Andy Miller of Georgia Health News. We're talking health care. Let me just share with you some of the tweets, and as we go forward in our discussion, maybe we can work in answers as we go. So Ross Hardy tweets, speaking of pools, what is a high-risk pool? I think I heard Ryan or Price talk about that. We can answer that right away. The high-risk pool is essentially people with pre-existing conditions.
Right. You put all the people who have these pre-existing conditions in insurance pools, and so they're funded by the government, and they have to put in premiums and stuff like that. That's happened in states before. It's interesting, in Georgia, we had one on the books. It was passed by the legislature, but it was never funded. In other states, they found that costs went out of control and they had to limit coverage and there was a waiting list to get into these. But that's one of the big points by Republicans, that they want to do this.
And that's exactly right why this is important, right? Let me make sure I've got this correct, everybody. If it's the individual mandate, the requirement that everybody have insurance that helps fund those with pre-existing conditions, makes it easier for insurance companies to insure everybody. If you take away the individual mandate, which Republicans are talking about doing, suddenly you don't have the money. The insurance company doesn't have that pool of cash, which is why you have to create special high-risk pools. And I'm not quite sure how those are funded.
Well, it's by government. I mean, the individuals that are being served and covered, they'll have to put in money too. But the way these things worked in the past in states, the state government had to fund them, and they a lot of them found that these costs kept going way and way up because these are the sickest people.
Okay, just a couple of other tweets, and we'll continue our conversation. Kyle Hayes. Is there a plan on the table that maintains gains of ACA, coverage gains, Medicaid, pre-existing, no life year cap, no cap, no lifetime cap? Yeah. We're going to get to that in a second. We're going to talk about what we think maybe they're going to do. We also got a tweet from Ben Andrews, who says that the Kaiser Family Foundation reports – Andy, you may know this, that premiums actually went down 5.5% each year of the last 2 years for employer-covered plans. That is interesting because that didn't seem quite correct to me.
Well, employer plans have moderated their cost increases. I mean, it used to be in the 90s and even past that is employers were getting double-digit rate increases every year. And that's why our deductibles went up, and that's why our premiums went up, and our networks got a little bit more restrictive and things like that. So it's been much better, yeah, cost inflation. But it's still there. It's still there.
Okay. Let's talk about where we might head next. We heard that really rather funny exchange your Senator Sherrod Brown from Ohio initiated, in which Tom Price says, well, yes, it's true that Donald Trump did say that we're having conversations. Andy, do we have any we should point out that you said Tom Price is smart on these things. He's actually the only member of Congress who's actually had an alternative plan that got some traction. Well, what did he want to do?
Well, he wanted to give tax credits to individuals and families buying insurance. He also talked about selling insurance across state lines. He talked about high-risk pools and some other facets of his plan. I think the analysis of his and other Republican plans has basically resulted in analysts saying, look, it's not going to cover as many people. I mean, that's the basic consensus. But we don't know what's going to come.
But, Andy, if you're an average person on Obamacare now, and you know how that works, right? You sign up in an exchange and you pay a certain amount of money to coverage.
Right.
If Tom Price gets his way, what would be different, right? I would just in my taxes get money to go out and buy whatever I wanted, or how would that work?
Well, Kevin, it's an interesting question. We don't really know the answer to that. I mean, we do know that there's a lot of people, like I interviewed somebody with cancer who's afraid that what's going to happen. You know, he's in the exchange now. He doesn't know how he will be handled, but we've heard a lot of theories and ideas from Republicans, but we don't have a plan yet. And I think we need to kind of hold our fire, so to speak, in terms of okay, let's evaluate it. But that'll be where the rubber meets the road.
And how long? I mean, you're tight on these issues, of course. But even if the Republicans would move at breakneck speed, we're talking years before things change, right?
Well, the worry, I think, Kevin, is that they'll do something very fast and not really study the effects of what it's going to be.
So I might, like your cancer patient,
yeah.
I have this pre-existing condition. Right now, under the law, I'm secure. In other words, I know how it all works.
Right.
But if all of a sudden the law about pre-existing conditions goes away and insured doesn't have to accept me with a pre-existing condition, I could be out in the cold. I mean, that's the...
Or you'll be in one of these high-risk pools like Bill and I were talking about. I mean, we don't know how it's all going to shake out, but those are the people probably the most worried about what's going to happen.
Yeah. And I think this rush to immediately repeal and then figure out what you're going to do later is unpalatable, because already it's starting to interrupt the insurance markets and other big industry involved in healthcare. But Senator Cassidy from Louisiana has come out with a general proposal in which they will block grant to all the states their health care, in which each individual state will therefore have their own health care system. And so you could, based on where you live, you know, determine whether or not you have health insurance.
Let's be careful, because I want to make sure I get that. There has been, for a long time, proposals by Republicans, particularly, Andy, to use block grants for Medicaid.
Right.
To say instead of it that Georgia should have the right to get a certain lump sum of money and then figure out on its own, it administer its own Medicaid plan and figure out who gets the money and who doesn't, rather than the federal government giving money that applies to each individual in their circumstances, right?
It's a plan that's been out there by Republicans for a long time, and Kellyanne Conway said it the other day on ABC, I believe, that she said, we're going to block grant Medicaid. And there's 2 million people in Georgia that are covered under Medicaid. Most the childbirths in this state are covered by that. Most people in nursing homes are covered by Medicaid. And so it's a big deal. And in order to, and if you give a lump sum to a state, the idea is, okay, state, Georgia, you can, here's the money, you're not going to get any more, you may get more next year, but you figure out the rules, you figure out who you're going to cover and who you're not going to cover. It's an issue that a lot of Democrats oppose, because they're afraid that benefits will get cut, beneficiaries will get cut off the program, and if the federal government doesn't, you know, has a bad year financially, they may even cut the amount that goes to a state.
So, you know, it's interesting, and again, all of you, please get in here. Andy, you point out that allowing insurance companies to sell across state lines could be very well, could possibly be part of a Republican replacement for Obamacare. Kevin, the point of that, of course, is to increase competition. That, right, if you're in one, if you've got just a certain number of insurance companies only authorized to sell within the state of Georgia, if you can't go to people outside of the state, you don't have as many providers
right.
to choose
from. And
again,
from. A core Republican principle of don't pick winners and losers, let the marketplace pick, you know, be able to cross state lines. I mean, I think as we've watched Tom Price during these hearings, you know, Andy and I were talking about this earlier, he knows, I mean, whether you agree with his politics or agree with what he'd like to do, I don't think there's much argument about his knowledge of the matter. And I think he recognizes this is pretty complicated, and he's being very careful in these hearings not to say anything that will come back to
right.
haunt him.
Right, and the reason, and that's a good point to make right now, because selling across state lines sounds like a very simple idea, but that really does present some significant complications because each state has its own insurance regulations, has their own commissioners in regulating the way policy. So that's much more complicated than it sounds like on the surface, isn't it, Andy?
Georgia's had a law, Bill, for several years on selling insurance over, you know, insurer can come into Georgia or is licensed here can sell a policy from out of state. It might be a Montana policy being sold in Georgia. But the fact is, no insurer has taken up that challenge or that opportunity. And so it really has, there's been no takers.
All right.
The wild card in all this, Bill, is that if Tom Price gets confirmed, which we all assume he will.
Yeah, because he needs a simple majority.
He's going to be working for Donald Trump. He's not going to be making those decisions himself. And we have a president who does not have a fixed ideology, and he's not does not come from a policy background. So it's going to be very difficult for them to come to some conclusion because President Trump is all over the map when it comes to health care.
Yeah, he told the Washington Post he wants insurance for everybody.
Everyone.
That sounds like Bernie Sanders, yeah. Actually. So
that was one of those moments where if you're a member of the leadership in Congress or if you're a Tom Price and you hear it, he told that to Robert Costa in the Washington Post, you're suddenly thinking, oh, my gosh, what has he just committed us to, Kevin?
Right. I mean, I do think that that is the confusion here. And think of all the markets and the people and the companies and doctors and everyone affected by this. We've got one of the biggest industries in the country on edge, not sure where this is all going to go. And I think that in the end, that's a precarious position to put the country in.
Ted Barfield asks, how is it that a bronze plan with a $5,800 deductible costing $900 a month is affordable in any way? And he does bring up a good point, Andy. One of the real complaints about ACA has been the deductibles are just so high that you wonder if they counterbalance the premium you're paying.
You know, it's a very legitimate criticism. I think employer plans have also seen deductibles go up increasingly, but I don't think they've reached the point that where the exchange is, and that's a valid criticism.
Okay, so again, we'd have no idea what Republicans are going to put in place. Billy alluded to the fact we do know that the other day President Trump did issue an executive order that. We really don't, I don't think, Andy, know the implications of entirely, but essentially he said to his agencies, he authorized them to look at various programs, expenditures that they're now involved with that accrue to the Affordable Care Act and begin making decisions about whether to continue those things or not. Is that a fair way of describing that?
It is. But most experts say that executive order really won't accomplish a whole lot.
It was symbolic.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And if Price, as expected, wins confirmation that he'll be able to do some things at that point.
Are tax credits, which has certainly been a big part of Tom Price's plan, as you said, my understanding is that his credit would his tax credit, the difference between a tax credit and a tax deduction is, I'll answer it, but anybody else want to jump on it? A tax credit, you get the total, it comes off the front end of your taxes in its entirety, right? A deduction is part of the percentage of other deductions you get for various things like your mortgage, your child care, all that sort of thing, right? Am I right about that? A tax credit typically is gives you more money back.
I mean, you talk tax policy.
Yeah, that's a tough one.
I think you need a better guess if that's the topic.
I think I'm right. The credit starts at $1,200 a year. It rises with age. This was the plan that he introduced. It is not adjusted for income. Everybody receives the same credit, rich or poor. And if that's part of the plan, it's hard to imagine how that makes health insurance any more affordable for people out there, yeah?
You know, one of the Republican talking points is interesting. It is a matter of words. What they're more talking about now is access to health care, not coverage for health care.
Yes.
Access, you know, we could have access to buying a Maserati tomorrow, and, you know, I can't afford it. So it's very important for us to distinguish access to health, quality health care is a lot different than coverage for quality health care.
All right. We're going to conclude this part of the conversation with this. We've already talked about repeal and replace, but we still don't know, Andy. There's been lots of back and forth. Trump wants it. Trump said in that Washington Post interview with Bob Costa, we'll do it all in one day. We're not going to do it in one day. And the Congress still
we're going to do it in one tweet.
Yes, one tweet. And the Congress still has not decided or figured out whether they can repeal and then have an extended window for perhaps 2 years in which Obamacare continues before they put a new plan in place. And Billy Lindvall's already shaking his head. Why?
I think that health care will be the dominant issue in the midterm elections. And I just think it is politically unpalatable to tell potentially millions of people that you have health insurance today, but you're probably not going to have it tomorrow.
Yeah, and insurance companies, you know, they deal on future and risk and things like that. They don't have to play ball. I mean, they can cover somebody this year, but they say, we're going to get out of this until we figure out what they're actually going to do in 2018 or 2020.
As long as we're talking about Tom Price, he had a rough go of it yesterday into the Senate Finance Committee from Democrats, certainly not Republicans. As we've pointed out, because of a rule passed by Democrats when they were in the majority, it only requires a majority vote in the Senate to confirm a nominee for a cabinet position, and the Republicans have a clear majority. But there's still been some questions raised about Price's involvement in buying stocks, particularly in terms of health care industries or health products that he has been involved with in terms of voting on issues that might affect those companies. He had a particularly tough exchange with Ron Wyden, the Democrat from Oregon. Let's just listen to a bit of it.
The reality is that everything that I did was ethical, above board, legal, and transparent. The reason that you know about these things is because we have made that information available in real time as required by the House Ethics Committee. So there isn't anything that you have divulged here that hasn't been public knowledge.
Your stake in Innate is more than 5 times larger than the figure you reported to ethics officials when you became a nominee. You also reported it in the questionnaire to the committee, and you had to revise it yesterday because it was wrong.
And the reason for that is because when asked about the value, I thought it meant the value at the time that I purchased the stock.
Kevin, a lot of fodder for critics, Democrats, but it's probably really going to have not much impact on his confirmation, is it?
I think you're right. I mean, no one has stood up on the Republican side and said they wouldn't vote for him, and that's what it would take for him not to be confirmed.
Let me point out that Tom Daschle 8 years ago was set to be the HHS secretary, what Price is about to be appointed to, and he had to withdraw his nomination because he did not pay taxes on a personal employee. And here you have a case where Tom Price, clearly was not transparent in his disclosure reports. It is very obvious that there was probable insider trading going on, and legislation wrote to impact his own personal stake in some of these stocks. which is so much more egregious than what Tom Daschle was forced to withdraw from.
Yeah, the stock trade that was probably the most interesting to me was the one where through his broker, Representative Price bought shares in a hip company or a hip device company, and then less than a week later introduced legislation that would presumably help that company and others in that
yeah,
business.
Yeah. Well, we'll watch this very carefully, but we do expect him to be confirmed. Andy, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about a couple of legislative matters in the state. Well, we're going to talk about casino gambling. Now, there's a sexy issue. But it's really been great to have you here. Will you come back as this moves forward and help us understand what they're doing up there?
I absolutely will come back. Glad to be here.
All right. Andy Miller of Georgia Health News. It's 2:46. Let's take our final break and come back and talk about gambling.
On the next Fresh Air, doomsday prep for the super rich. We talk with Evan Osnos of The New Yorker about how some tech billionaires and venture capitalists are preparing for natural or man-made disaster by stockpiling food, water, ammunition, and creating escape havens. We'll also follow up on our previous discussions about Donald Trump. Join us.
Fresh Air, this afternoon at 3 on your GPB station.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. I'm here with Kevin Riley of the AJC, Billy Linville, who is a government affairs. He's a lobbyist. That's what you are. You're a lobbyist.
Less lobby and more strategic communication.
Oh, okay. Kevin, really interesting development this week. I would have been willing to bet, and in fact, I said it on our air here at least a couple times, that enabling legislation that would allow voters across the state to decide whether they want casinos in Georgia would probably have to cook for a few years before it would really get anywhere. Now, all of a sudden this week, we've seen some breaks in the possibility of this happening. On Monday night, Senator Brandon Beach and Ron Stevens came in here to do lawmakers. And they actually said they're about to introduce a proposal, which we expect is going to come this week. And one of the things that's really appealing about it to a lot of people is that it would offer not just HOPE scholarship money, but for the first time ever, needs-based scholarship money, which is a whole new ballgame. Let's listen. Stacey Evans was on the show, and she talked about this with Ron Stevens. Let's just listen to a little of their exchange.
I don't have a real strong opinion about whether casino gambling is right or wrong, but I do have very strong opinions about what we do with the money if it comes here. And I think that you're seeing from these polls that there's a will in our state to bring this type of gambling, this type of opportunity for shopping and entertainment and other things. And I just want to make sure that we're putting the money in a place where it will give us the most bang for the buck.
We're starting the conversation with 30% going to needs base, and it could change. But 30% is our floor, and we both committed to that. So I think all of us at this table agree that there's a huge void in the needs-based piece, and that'll be 30% of all the new money that comes out of it.
So, Kevin, the complaint about HOPE has been for many years that it usually goes to people who already have the means to send their kids to college because they're in better schools, their families have more money, and unfortunately it is people who in underserved communities that aren't getting HOPE scholarships. A needs-based scholarship is a pretty sexy lure, isn't it?
Well, I think what we're seeing here is something really simple. Gambling is legal in about 40 states. The gambling companies are extremely powerful. They have very deep pockets, very sophisticated. They know how to sell this idea. In Georgia, they're hitting all the buttons right now. And that's why I think you see it moving faster than a lot of people thought it would.
Billy, you want to weigh in on this?
Yeah, well, it's important to be reminded that this would be a constitutional amendment, which would require 2/3 vote in the Senate and the House. So unlike other issues, this will the Republicans will have to be forced to compromise and work out deals with Democrats because there will need to be Democratic votes.
There are several layers to this. First, we need what they call enabling legislation. The legislature has to say yes, and the governor has to sign or let sit without vetoing a bill that would then Senate to a statewide constitutional amendment in 2018. But then an individual municipality, Kevin, the city of Atlanta, for instance, would have to, once if it passes the voters of the state, they would have to take it up separate from that. So there's a long way to go before you're going to get to play your first slot in underground Atlanta, Kevin.
Absolutely. Or to find the sports book so that we can bet on the Falcons in the Super Bowl. We had the folks from Central Atlanta Progress in at the AJC last week, and they've done a couple studies on this thing. And one of the things they point out is that it puts a big burden on whatever municipality or county the casino is located in, because all of a sudden you've got roads to maintain, you've got police protection and fire protection to consider. So while I think it has a lot of layers, I don't think that the folks in the state legislature are going to worry about problems they might create for the city of Atlanta on this one.
Well, the other interesting development this week, Billy, is that for the first time, Governor Deal kind of opened a window. He opened the door a crack, let a little pro-casino sunlight in, essentially saying, well, as long as it doesn't impact HOPE dollars, I might not have a real problem with this.
Yeah, that Georgia's lottery program is probably the best run in the entire country, a real model. And I think Governor Deal was very concerned that that would be impacted. And from the legislation last year, he clearly wanted the casinos to pay much more in tax, which they apparently have agreed to do this year. So for the first time, he seems open to being supportive.
There are a couple of – go ahead. Do you want to weigh in?
One of the things Central Atlanta Progress's study appears to show is that if you bring in casinos, less money will be spent on the lottery, but the overall money available is potentially greater.
Yeah.
And so I think that somewhere in there, the governor, because he does, you know, the governor, right, appoints the lottery board. It's really important to him. And in this, the legislation we've been hearing about, there'll be a new gambling commission, right? Because there was some argument early on about who would be in charge of the casinos. And now it looks like they're going to be a separate gambling commission.
And it appears that part of this bill will allow a casino, not just in Atlanta, but probably in a place like Savannah.
Well, here's the other development I think that's fascinating in terms of this. First of all, I recognize, and I started it, I'm using now the wrong word. We are no longer talking about having casinos in the state of Georgia. We're talking about having resorts that will feature gambling. That's now they've eliminated the
word casino. And that's
actually
going to be a contentious issue too.
Absolutely.
Because part of the way a big company like MGM sells this is the entertainment venue, the concerts, things like that. But I know that there are some folks in the city concerned, you know, these nonprofit entertainment venues who believe they might be cut out of some things or undercut by something like that are beginning to make a little bit of noise.
And now there's efforts underway to try to put gaming into the new hotel at the airport. So you're seeing efforts to continually try to expand these type of ideas.
Yeah, I do think the entertainment issues, and Lisa Clark, our producer, pointed out to me that, you know, venues like the Fox Theater, the Woodruff Arts Center, the Alliance Theater, the Symphony even, once you've got Wayne Newton coming into town, you may have trouble trying to compete
with
them.
But I believe the gaming companies will have an answer to that question, too. They'd probably say, well, you're not getting Wayne Newton now.
Well, then why bother?
Despite your hopes.
All right. I want to listen to just a little bit more of the argument that's being made by the pro-lottery, by the pro, not casinos anymore, resort crowd. Here's Brandon Beach from Lawmakers the other night.
You know, we will see a $2 billion minimum investment, again, with 5,000 to 10,000 jobs, 20% tax rate, and no public dollars. This will all be privately funded.
That's my next question.
And so let me tell you, if a company wanted to come and do that, we'd be rolling out the red carpet. So I think that we have to have discussions on this and have to look at this, because this is a major investment in our state.
All right. That was Senator Brandon Beach talking to Scott Slade, who I'm happy to say is hosting lawmakers this year and letting me go home at night. Thank you very much, Mr. Slade. Sam Burnham tweets to us a couple things. He says, resort equals stay there, eat there, park there, spend there, and not the rest of the town, to the point that we were all making. But then he asked this question, what's the real economic impact of a casino, meaning the benefits to areas outside the casino itself? Well, we don't know, but Kevin, you're right. The MGM Grand folks, they'll have an answer to that question.
Absolutely. And one of the other things, too, that there's an argument on both sides, and the Central Atlanta Progress Study claims is that it won't really draw most of the business from out of state. You know, you get sometimes it's positioned as, well, people are going to North Carolina to gamble, they're going other places to gamble, and we'd like people from out of state to come here. Most of it will be people who are here now, and they'll just shift their spend to the resort gaming complex.
All right. Well, we're going to watch this unfold. I just find it fascinating that this appears to be something moving more quickly than certainly I'd ever expected. And I think your point is well made. These guys now know how to come into a community and win the support they want. They've done it a lot, and they get better at it all the time. So we'll watch it. Yeah, Billy?
And just one word. Ralph Reed and a lot of the social conservatives in the state are very organized in opposition.
Well, that was going to be my
final. So it's going to be interesting to see what impact they can really have.
That's right. And what we're going to see here is something that takes us all the way back to the early 90s when Zell Miller, as governor, introduced lottery to begin with. That went to a statewide amendment, and he almost got his hat handed to him on that statewide amendment because of the religious right. So we'll watch and see how that unfolds. We're out of time. That show went really quickly. Andy Miller, it was so great to have Andy here. He's still in the studio. I really do want you to come back and continue this conversation.
Be glad to.
Billy Linville, always a pleasure to have you and Kevin Riley. Thanks so much. Come back. I like it when the boss is here. We don't need all of your underlings here all the time.
I think they like to have me here rather than at the office.
Jenny Ahmed says, by the way, that Trump is now speaking. He's at Homeland Security. Among other things he's talking about, he is going to build the wall. He's going to talk about that today. He is going to try to deny federal funding to sanctuary cities that protect undocumented workers, contrary to federal. And Kevin's handing me something. Oh,
breaking news,
Kevin.
From the AJC.
Yeah,
Mary
us.
Tyler Moore has died at 80.
Oh, well, that's really a very sad way to end the show. All right. Mary Tyler Moore. Wow. Kevin, thank you for letting us know about that. We're out of time. Once again, if you want to be part of our citizen panel, if you think you deserve a place on that panel, probably you do. Call us, 678-757-4472. Leave us a succinct message, I mean short, about what your qualifications are, what you do for a living, what your point of view is, and we may very well want you to be one of the people who join us on that panel. If you can't listen to us when we're on the radio, remember, you can subscribe to our podcast at iTunes or wherever the heck you get your podcast from. I'm Bill Nygut. We'll be back here at 3 o'clock on Friday with another edition of Political Rewind. Have a great evening.